This is a Rabble Podcast Network show.
New voices in your head.
It's Radio Free Radio.
Thanks for tuning in to 93.3 CFMU Radio. This is Progressive Voices. I'm Riaz Sayani-Molgi. Today on Progressive Voices, I am airing a recording of a lecture given at Leuna Station by Angela Davis. The lecture was entitled, 150 Years Later, Abolition in the 21st Century, and it was hosted by the McMaster Center for Scholarship in the Public Interest. Angela Davis is the author of 8 books and has lectured throughout the United States, as well as in Europe, Africa, Asia, Australia, and South America. In recent years, a persistent theme of her work has been the range of social problems associated with incarceration and the generalized criminalization of those communities that are most affected by poverty and racial discrimination. She draws upon her own experiences in the early 70s as a person who spent 18 months in jail and on trial after being placed on the FBI's 10 most wanted list. She has also conducted extensive research on numerous issues related to race, gender, and imprisonment. Her most recent books are Abolition Democracy and Are Prisons Obsolete? She is now completing a book on prisons in American history. Angela is a member of the executive board of the Women of Color Resource Center, a San Francisco Bay Area organization that emphasizes popular education of and about women who live in conditions of poverty. She also works with Justice Now, which provides legal assistance to women in prison and engages in advocacy for the abolition of imprisonment as the dominant strategy for addressing social problems. Internationally, she is affiliated with Sisters Inside, a similar organization based in Queensland, Australia. Like many other educators, Professor Davis is especially concerned with the general tendency to devote more resources and attention to the prison system than to educational institutions. Having helped to popularize the notion of a prison industrial complex, she now urges her audiences to think seriously about the future possibility of a world without prisons and to help forge a 21st century abolitionist movement. Here's what she had to say in Hamilton, Ontario.
Thank all of you for coming out this evening. It is truly a pleasure to be here in Hamilton, Ontario, my first visit at McMaster University. And it is truly an honor to have been invited to participate in this series, which is sponsored by the Center for Scholarship in the Public Interest. Am I right? And I would especially like to thank Professor Henry Giroux, whose work has had such a profound impact on a range of fields, from education to cultural studies, on critical theories and pedagogies of social justice. I've been following his work for many years and was very excited to finally meet him. And as a matter of fact, as he spoke, I said, well, I wish I could just sit here and listen to him. But I'm very happy to have been invited to speak this evening. And I have chosen to offer some reflections on the topic of the continuing challenges of abolition 150 years after the issuing in the United States of the Emancipation Proclamation. Now, this topic, of course, is related to the work that I do, both my scholarship and activism. For the vast majority of my life, it seems, I have been doing work in some way related to prisons. And I'm one of those activists or scholar activists who have been thinking about prison issues in a large context for many decades. And as a matter of fact, I could probably narrate the story of my entire life using anti-prison activism as an anchor. Because I could tell you that before I was born, my mother was active in the campaign to free the Scottsboro Nine. And over 80 years after this case emerged, which of course led to the fraudulent convictions of nine black men on charges of having raped two white women, death sentences, and many, many long years in prison. Finally, the Alabama legislature is poised to offer posthumous pardons to all nine members of the Scottsboro Boys. Almost a century later. Now, about a quarter of a century after the Scottsboro Boys, I became active in many campaigns to free political prisoners, Huey Newton, Los Siete de la Raza, Nelson and Winnie Mandela, Lolita Lebron, and the case that in many ways reshaped my life, the case of the Soledad brothers, George Jackson, Frida Drumgo, and John Cluche, who were charged with killing a guard in 1970 inside Soledad prison. So I could tell you that I was fired from my first job at UCLA, first for being a communist, and then when that didn't work, I was fired for speaking out on behalf of political prisoners. And that was according to Ronald Reagan and the regents at that time, behavior unbecoming a professor. So, and then, of course, I could tell you how I myself was arrested and charged with three capital crimes and how I was freed by a massive international movement that stretched from Europe to Africa to Asia to South and North America, including here in Canada. But that's not the story I'm telling you this evening. I'm going to attempt to engage with a larger story. I want to begin with a series of dilemmas surrounding the sesquicentennial of the Emancipation Proclamation in the United States. And, of course, I should make the point that Canada was not unaffected by the Civil War in the U.S. And by the strategy that was announced by Lincoln in 1863. As a matter of fact, Canada was implicated in both sides of the Civil War. Former slaves who had traveled to freedom to Canada via the Underground Railroad joined the Union forces after the issuance of the Emancipation Proclamation. But the government of Canada did not prevent Confederate forces from seeking refuge in Canada as well. And so while I will refer primarily to implications of that history for the contemporary United States, I'm also keeping in mind that unfortunately Canada follows too often in the footsteps of its neighbor to the south. But for now, another point. The story of the end of U.S. slavery belongs not only to us here in North America, but to the world. As a matter of fact, black Americans have been the beneficiaries of solidarity generated in all parts of the world. The anti-slavery abolitionist movements all over the world, sanctuary from slavery offered by Canada and many other countries. I mentioned the Scottsboro Nine campaign. That campaign became as well known as it did precisely because of the international solidarity that was generated in connection with the case. And then in the 1950s, there was this notorious kissing case in the state of North Carolina, where a young black boy who was about 6 years old kissed a white girl with whom he had been playing. He was arrested on rape charges. And only because there was an international outcry were the charges eventually dropped. And of course, I've already referred to political prisoners, and I might mention my own case and the solidarity movements in places like Brazil and Vietnam and Sri Lanka and Senegal and the former Soviet Union and France and Germany, both East and West, and so forth and so on. And parenthetically, I might mention that today, Lynette Peltier, who is probably the longest held political prisoner in the country, is still behind bars. And you here in Canada have a relationship to that case. And then there's Mumia Abu-Jamal, and of course the Cuban Five. But perhaps we can talk about those cases during the question and answer period. But I'm primarily interested in the fact that people all over the world have been inspired by the black freedom struggle to forge. They've been inspired to forge activist movements addressing a whole range of oppressive conditions in their own countries. There's a relationship of inspiration and mutuality between the historical South African freedom struggle and the historical Black American freedom struggle. Martin Luther King was inspired by Gandhi to engage in nonviolent campaigns against racism, and the Dalit of India have been inspired by the struggles of Black Americans. More recently, young Palestinians protested the segregation of buses and highways got on buses knowing full well they would be arrested, that were reserved for settlers traveling from one settlement to another inside occupied Palestine on segregated highways. Do you know what they call themselves? Palestinian freedom riders. In the United States, I'll not speak about Canada. I'll do my critique and focus it on the U.S. You can draw the implications for Canada, if you wish. Our collective relationship to history is seriously flawed. Faulkner once wrote, I think it was in Requiem for a Nun, that the past is never dead. It's not even past. And so we live with the ghosts of slavery. And I would like to pose the question, why are we not vigorously celebrating the 150th anniversary of the Emancipation Proclamation? It's very bizarre. It would seem that this would be one of the most important historical anniversaries to observe. Am I right? Yes. But I've seen very little. Obama wrote a proclamation on December 31st asking people to celebrate January 1st, but I think it only came out on December 31st, so most people didn't even get it because they were out partying on New Year's Eve. And then, of course, another anniversary will be coming up, the 150th anniversary of the passage of the 13th Amendment to the Constitution. And I'm wondering what will happen then. Maybe we'll get another film. because it seems that that's all we got in connection with slavery. I won't talk about the film. Maybe later. But I begin with this discussion of the Emancipation Proclamation issued 150 years ago, which was not so much a question of the emancipation of people of African descent by a president of the U.S. It was more a military strategy than anything else. And if one actually looks at the text of the Emancipation Proclamation, one discovers that as much space is devoted to the exceptions, that is to say, as long as states remained within the Union, or as long as regions of states were loyal to the Union, they could keep their slaves. So slavery was all right as long as it remained within the Union. Now, if we examine the meaning of this historical moment, however, it seems to me that we are better able to understand both the failures and the successes of emancipation, the dialectics of emancipation. We live with the popular myth that Lincoln freed the slaves. Is that what they tell you here in Canada as well? Which continues to be perpetrated and perpetuated in popular culture, of course, even by the film Lincoln, which I'm sure you've seen. But Lincoln did not free the slaves. As a matter of fact, according to Eric Foner, who's written a wonderful book on Lincoln and slavery, quote, "The Emancipation Proclamation is perhaps the most misunderstood of the documents that have shaped American history. Contrary to legend, Lincoln did not free the nearly 4 million slaves with a stroke of his pen. It had no bearing on slaves in the four border states, since they were not in rebellion. It also exempted certain parts of the Confederacy occupied by the Union. All told, it left perhaps 750,000 slaves in bondage." Moreover, popular narratives about the end of slavery erase the agency of black people themselves. And I suppose we can say that if Lincoln did not really free the slaves, he was shrewd enough to recognize that the only hope of winning the Civil War resided in creating the opportunity for black people to fight for their own freedom. And as a matter of fact, W.E.B. Du Bois, in the fourth chapter of Black Reconstruction, which is the one text about the history of the United States that everyone should read, that so few people have read, and everyone should read that. Chapter 4 is entitled The General Strike, because he uses the vocabulary of the labor movement to convey the consequences of the Emancipation Proclamation. So chapter 4 is called The General Strike, How the Civil War Meant Emancipation, and How the black worker, he doesn't say the slave, he says the black worker, won the war by a general strike which transferred his labor from the Confederate planter to the Northern invader, in whose army lines workers began to be organized as a new labor force. And so he argues that it was because of the withdrawal of labor from the slaveholders and the bestowal of that labor on the Union Army that the war itself was won. Frederick Douglass said in 1865 that the Civil War was begun, quote, "in the interest of slavery on both sides. The South was fighting to take slavery out of the Union, and the North was fighting to keep it in the Union. The South fighting to get it beyond the limits of the United States Constitution, and the North fighting for the old guarantees, both despising the Negro, insulting the Negro." And it was what Du Bois called this army of striking labor that eventually produced the 200,000 soldiers, quote, whose evident ability to fight decided the war. And the soldiers were not only men. There were also women involved in that fight. As a matter of fact, we know Harriet Tubman as the conductor on the Underground Railroad who brought more people to freedom than any other. She was also a spy and had to fight for her military pension for many years later. Du Bois writes in Black Reconstruction about the fugitive slaves who had built their own communities and then worked for the Union Army. And he points out that they did not hesitate to pay the taxes that were asked of them from the wages they received. And those taxes built hospitals, et cetera, et cetera. But I want to fast forward for a moment to the 60s, and I want to go back to that era. And I want to point out that the mid-20th century movements that we know as the civil rights movement, right, were only necessary because slavery had not been fully abolished. As a matter of fact, what we call the civil rights movement, we should call the 20th century abolitionist movement. Because those struggles were about the effort to abolish the vestiges of slavery. If slavery had been abolished, there would have been no second-class citizenship. Black people would have enjoyed full and equal citizenship. But let's go back to the 1860s. And we discover that one of the most hidden eras of U.S. history is the period of radical Reconstruction. It's certainly the most radical period. There were Black elected officials. There was the development of public education. This is the theme of these series, public education, education for the public good. And what many people do not recognize is that in the course of passionately struggling for the right to public education in the aftermath of slavery, Black people actually established the terrain on which public education in the South was created. So many poor white people who later became vicious segregationists only had the right to education as a direct consequence of those struggles in the immediate aftermath of slavery. Of course, there was the creation of what we now know as historically Black colleges and universities. There was economic development. As a matter of fact, some of the most radical legislation was passed during that era. And not only legislation that affected former slaves, but legislation that, for example, affected all women. More progressive divorce laws were passed. Laws that guaranteed to women the right to own property, thus challenging the old patriarchal structure of society. But we don't know very much about that. Certainly not in the U.S., but not here in Canada either, do we? And it is often assumed that Jim Crow segregation was a direct consequence of slavery. It was a kind of transference of slavery to the era that followed slavery. But that wasn't so much the case. As a matter of fact, it was an effort to to destroy this the radical accomplishments of that era that had implications not only for black people, but for all people. And as a matter of fact, we see during that era the emergence of an approach to punishment, emergence of punishment strategies that help us to understand what is happening today under the impact of global capitalism and the disestablishment of welfare states everywhere. The Ku Klux Klan emerged. 1866 is generally the year that's given. But these repressive formations, along with the convict lease system, in order to manage black bodies that were now free. And of course, the abolition of slavery would have meant, had abolition truly occurred, it would have meant far more than the negative abolition of slavery. It would have meant far more than simply getting rid of the chains. It would have meant the building of new institutions. And this is what the campaign during the years of radical Reconstruction was about. It was about building schools, about housing, about health care, about all of those institutions that would have been necessary in order to integrate former slaves into a thriving democracy. And this is why Du Bois talked about abolition democracy. Abolition by itself was not enough. And in order to prevent these institutions from emerging, and it wasn't just the slaveholders. As a matter of fact, it wasn't even primarily the slaveholders. It was the capitalists. It was the northern capitalists who are responsible for the creation of these new institutions of racism, Jim Crow. Now, let's fast forward from 1877, which is the year that's generally proposed as the end of radical Reconstruction, to the 1960s. We were confronting issues in the 1950s and the 1960s that should have been resolved in the 1860s. So therefore, we had the Montgomery bus boycott, and you know the names of some of the figures, right? Rosa Parks, everybody knows Rosa Parks. Maybe not everybody knows Claudette Colvin, who had been arrested for riding on a bus in Montgomery before that, or Joanne Robinson, who wrote the book, The Montgomery Bus Boycott and the Women Who Started It. The women have been largely erased, with the exception of perhaps Rosa Parks. But I always like to point out that the Montgomery bus boycott and the movement we call the Civil Rights Movement, which is probably better named the Black Freedom Movement, because it was about more than civil rights, actually, sort of got stuck there with civil rights was a part of it, but not the, there were also economic issues, economic rights that were at issue as well. But the women who are perhaps the ones who were most responsible for the success of that boycott were black women maids and washerwomen and cooks, because these were the women who refused to ride the bus. Now, I pointed out that the that the movement was much larger. And there has been an ongoing attempt to fit that movement into a small frame, into the frame of civil rights. And I'm not suggesting that civil rights is not immensely important. It is, but freedom is more capacious than civil rights. And there were some of us who insisted that it was not simply a question of acquiring the formal rights to fully participate in society, but rather also it was about, and this goes back to slavery, the 40 acres and a mule that dropped out of the abolitionist agenda in the 19th century. And so education and healthcare and housing dropped out of the agenda of the so-called civil rights movement. And of course, there was the question of ending the police occupation of black communities that organizations like the Black Panther Party raised. And it's so interesting. If you look at that 10-point program that was formulated in 1966, 100 years after the founding of the Ku Klux Klan in 1866, you see that program recapitulated abolitionist agendas, and it continues to resonate in the 21st century. It's interesting, isn't it, that the Black Panther Party doesn't get included in the U.S. national narratives of democracy. The civil rights movement is represented as the triumph of democracy, that which has allowed the U.S. to claim its status as the model democracy in the world, right? But the Black Panther Party kind of like falls away, right? It's on the margins, and if you look at that 10-point program, you'll see why. And of course, the racism that was attached to the institution of slavery is perhaps more a force in the contemporary United States than it was during the period that gave rise to what we know as the civil rights movement. And this may be a controversial statement, I don't know. But I am so angry about this discourse of a post-racial society. All you have to do all you have to do is elect a black president, and all of that historical racism, all of those institutions that are so entrenched with racism somehow fall away. That makes no sense at all. And as a matter of fact, after Obama was elected the first time, a prisoner said, well, there may be one black man in the White House, but that doesn't cancel out the million black men and women in the big house. And so when I speak about racism, I'm not only speaking about the racism that has taken up residency in the psyches of so many people, including black people and people of color. Nobody is immune to the ideological toxicity of racism. But I'm also talking about the racism that is lodged in the structures of our institutions. The fact that all we need to do is open our eyes and we see that even as we celebrate the ascendancy of people of color to high places in our political and economic hierarchies, their positions cannot compensate for the fact that there are now more black men under the control of the criminal justice system than there were enslaved in 1850. This is what Michelle Alexander calls the new Jim Crow. But if you want to call it the new Jim Crow, we have to acknowledge that it is far more virulent, especially because of the reign of global capitalism. So many people at the bottom of the hierarchy have been relegated to oblivion. They are considered detritus. They're not even recognized in political discourse. And of course, this is a class strategy. The term poor is hardly ever used in the U.S. And Obama talks about the middle class. Like, whatever happened to the working class? And of course, people all over the world recognized the convergence of race and poverty as a result of the Katrina. You remember those images? But now Katrina has led to, you know, what Naomi Klein calls disaster capitalism. So now New Orleans is being rebuilt, but it will not accommodate poor black people in numbers that even begin to match their pre-Katrina presence. So there's no poor people anymore. There are no working class people anymore. Scott Walker in Wisconsin, you remember the campaign against the public workers in Wisconsin tried to erase public workers. And so this means that the challenges of scholarship and activism are vast today. We have to fight for the right to recognize, to discursively acknowledge poor people and working class people. And then, of course, working class issues, if we move from the field of discourse to the issues that ought to be associated with the working class, they have to embrace far more than what are narrowly construed as labor issues. They have to embrace, for example, reproductive rights. And what has narrowly been represented as women's issues. They have to embrace violence against women. They have to embrace a whole range of issues, including LGBTQ issues. And of course, we know that the immigrant rights movement is central to any struggle for democracy in the U.S., in Canada, in Europe, in this post-colonial era, immigrant rights have emerged as one of the primary arenas of the struggle for democracy. And so we can say that what civil rights was to the 20th century, the civil rights of immigrants are to the 21st century. And so few of the really important issues that demand our attention have been subject to extensive public discussion. So if the working class has been excised from political discourse, so have serious discussions about education, the state of our schools, the continuing crisis of over-incarceration and over-punishment. The U.S. is a prison nation. Of course,
there are approximately 2.5 million people behind bars. And that constitutes 25% of the world's incarcerated population. Now, it would be different if the population of the U.S. Approached that of China or India, but it doesn't. The U.S. has 5% of the world's population, but 25% of the incarcerated population. And it's not only that people who no longer fit into the structure of contemporary society under the impact of global capitalism, it's not only that they're warehoused and thrown away into these technologically advanced prisons that have developed carceral technologies that are beyond anyone's imagination. But that this process has become profitable itself. So if they're in prison largely because they don't fit into a society that places profits before people, and as a matter of fact, the jobs that used to be available have been exported, the whole process of deindustrialization that occurred during the 80s, it's not coincidental that the very period of the rise of global capitalism and deindustrialization and structural adjustment and the dismantling of welfare states was the period of the rise of the institution of the prison, the rise of the prison industrial complex, as a matter of fact. And so it's not only that this industry, this punishment industry, has become immensely profitable. So profitable that the private prison corporations were responsible for writing the repressive anti-immigrant legislation in Arizona and Alabama, because they see immigrant detention as the next most profitable feel for them. I mean, it's crazy, isn't it? It's absolutely insane. And then this strategy and these institutions have been exported. They have been exported all over the world. So it's not only in the countries of the global north that you find these massive, oftentimes super maximum security prisons, but it's also in Africa, it's also in South America, and especially in that's my timer. Sorry. Sorry about that. So I just have a few more minutes, but let me say, especially in places that are in the process of producing surplus populations. In Colombia, for example, where people have been thrown off their land, this whole process of deterritorialization, people, Afro-descended people and indigenous people who've been thrown off their land. And in order to make way for these huge agribusiness firms to grow crops like sugarcane, so that we who live in the countries of the global north can purchase biofuel for our cars and feel good about not polluting the environment. And in the meantime, people lose their means of subsistence. The very people who were the guarantors biodiversity of the land are thrown into slums, and prisons are now being built because they are destined to inhabit these places where surplus populations are sent. So, you see, the U.S. is a prison nation. That's the point. To say, this is not even to talk about the importance of the prison as a venue of torture in the context of the so-called war on terror. Let me say, before I conclude, that in my opinion, what is most important about this era is a consciousness of interconnectedness of various struggles. We can no longer afford to simply focus on a single issue. And as a result of the work of academics, we've acquired, I would say, feminist academics. We've acquired such vocabularies as the vocabularies of intersectionality, right? Right? Well, I could actually do another lecture about the ways in which certain concepts and certain knowledges actually have their origin in struggles for social justice, but because they become canonized in the academy, and because we don't learn ways of linking communities and universities in our citational practices, those of us who engage in research, we do not know how to cite anything other than other books or other articles. And so there is a major, major backstory to intersectionality. But the point that I want to make, that wasn't actually the point. That was a parenthetical observation. The point that I want to make is that we need now to begin seriously thinking about the intersectionality of struggles. For example, I do a lot of work with the prison abolition movement. And we have recognized how important it is to look, for example, at women in prison. Even though women constitute a relatively small minority of prisoners all over the world, if you examine the conditions of women and the experiences of women as represented by themselves, you gain a knowledge of the ways in which different modes of violence are very much interconnected. The feminist slogan, the personal is political, acquires a much more complicated meaning. The intimate violence that women in prison have experienced is very much related to the state violence they experience when they go to prison. And so we can develop an analysis of state violence that has to take into consideration the fact that the bodies that are most consistently the targets of violence in the world are female bodies. They're women's bodies. Even though we think about violence as primarily a male phenomenon. And then we have to go further and say, okay, we're talking about male, female. We're using a binary a notion of gender. Maybe we shouldn't be restricted to this notion of gender, which only allows male and female, as the prison system does. And so, we begin to think about gender nonconformity, various modes of transgender expression, and we realize how the
very institution of the prison is a gendering institution. And it affects all of us in the sense that it lodges this binary notion of gender in our minds and in our emotions. So this is what I mean when I say we need to consider the intersectionality of struggles. And we need more than ever a feminist approach. A feminist approach. Let me end. I really have gone over time now. I wanted to end by going back to this way in which freedom struggles of the past have been forced into these narrow frames, these small frames, you know, someone like Martin Luther King, who is the towering figure of what we call the Black radical tradition, he has been so edited that he fits into the version of democracy related to neoliberalism of contemporary global capitalism. I mean, it's interesting, almost everybody in the world knows Martin Luther King, but most of what they know is that he had a dream, right? That's about all they know. And, you know, I'm actually kind of tired of that dream. I wanted to conclude by telling you that in the last presidential address he delivered to his organization, which was, of course, the Southern Christian Leadership Conference. It was on August 16th, 1967. And he was assassinated in the following April, so he never had the opportunity to give another one. He asked the question, where do we go from here? And this was his answer. We must honestly face the fact that the movement must address itself to the question of restructuring the whole of American society. There are 40 million poor people here, and one day we must ask the question, why are there 40 million poor people in America? And when you begin to ask that question, you're raising a question about the economic system, about a broader distribution of wealth. This is not the Martin Luther King that you know. When you ask that question, you begin to question the capitalist economy. This is not the Martin Luther King whose monument is in Washington and whose writings are quoted on this amazing wall. And I'm saying, I'm continuing the quote, that more and more we have to begin to ask questions about the whole society. We are called upon to help the discouraged beggars in life's marketplace. But one day we must come to see that an edifice which produces beggars needs restructuring. It means that questions must be raised. And you see, my friends, when you deal with this, you begin to ask the question, who owns the oil? You begin to ask the question, who owns the iron ore? You begin to ask the question, why is it that people have to pay water bills in a world that's two-thirds water? And so I could continue. This is what he was thinking about during the last period of his life. And that version of Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. has been totally edited out of of U.S. history. He considered racism
exploitation, militarism to be a dangerous triumvirate that were responsible for a range of problems in the world. And I think he would also agree that the consciousness of the process of moving towards freedom has to be far more complicated than anyone ever imagined it might be at that time. And I'm especially interested in assisting with the placing of Palestinian freedom on our political agendas. I had the opportunity to work with Stefan Hessel, who just recently died at the age of 93, who has an amazing history. You can Google him, Stefan Hessel. His funeral just took place recently in Paris, but he was present for the formulation of the Declaration of Human Rights. He was a member of the resistance in France during the Nazi occupation. And he wrote this wonderful pamphlet called Indignez-vous, which has sold something like 4 million copies, calling upon the people of the world to join the struggle for social justice. And he was especially concerned about the Palestinian people. But I will finally say that that people are beginning to say all around the world that we need to struggle together as a global community, as global communities, to create a world that's free of racism and especially Islamophobia, which is drawn from the worst histories of racism and made them even more toxic. A world from which poverty has been expunged and the availability of food is not subject to the demands of capitalist profit. And as a matter of fact, that food that is subject to the demands of capitalist profit ends up making people sick instead of nourishing them. So let's not even talk about that. A world without homophobia and transphobia, and without the prison industrial complex, and where everyone learns how to respect the environment and all of the creatures, human and non-human, who inhabit our worlds. A world where equality, justice, and peace prevail. Thank you very much.
This is Progressive Voices on 93.3 CFMU Radio. Progressive Voices is also available online at news site rabble.ca. You can access Progressive Voices at www.rabble.ca/podcasts/progressive-voices, where you can find all of the show's episodes uploaded as MP3 files. You can also subscribe to the show on iTunes. Take care, and I'll talk to you next week.